This is the First Time Podcast.
Part reality series.
Part writer's masterclass. It's a podcast about the first time
you publish a book.
I'm Kate Mildenhall.
And I'm Catherine Collette. Welcome to The First Time.
Kate here. This is just an indulgent little plug for an upcoming workshop I'm running for Writers Victoria. It's called The Post-Publication Hustle, and it is all about what comes next after your book has hit shelves. How do you keep it there on shelves in the next year or the next 2 years? How do you keep it in people's minds? We'll do some creative resilience. We'll set some goals. We'll look at strategies for overcoming rejection and failure and all the big bad feelings, and hopefully get set for a cracking 2020. It's on Sunday, November the 10th, 10 to 4 at Writers Vic. Check out the Writers Victoria website or our show notes for booking details.
Kate.
Hello. How are you going?
Good. Guess what we're going to talk about?
What are we talking about today, Catherine?
Tax.
Tax?
Yeah.
It's my most favourite subject. How did you know that tax gets me so excited?
Tax took me so long this year. Does it take you a long time?
Well, it always takes me a long time because I think when you have small amounts of money, you try and make the tax work really, really hard. Oh.
We should start with that, actually. Start with the micro bit.
The micro bit. Let's start with that.
So what is your system for deductible expenses?
What is my system? My system is, you know, the Spike where I put all of my receipts. I don't have the fancy app. Oh. I heard them talking about them on the Pineapple Project, actually, the last
episode.
I'd
be keen to hear about the app.
Yeah.
The Spike. So this is like just
a physical Spike. I put all the receipts on there.
I never have a Spike. However, so sharp on there.
It is. It's very sharp. But of course, now I don't actually use that because I now have one of the very important things that my accountant told me was, you know, get yourself a different bank account that is your business bank account.
Yeah. Okay.
So I have my lovely... It is pink. I don't know for what reason. The bank
so
just sent me a
bank
out of interest. Credit card.
I've just been trying to set up a business account.
Well, it's just the same. It's actually not a business account. It's just a separate account in with all of my complicated mortgage and, you know, the rest of it. But it's a separate account. It's just got my name on it. So it hasn't got my, you know, our other shared kind of things in it. Yep. I have a separate card for it.
Yeah.
And I lovingly call that credit card my book credit card, because of course
that's a good way to do
that
it.
That is what I buy all my books.
And is
my
it a
tickets.
Credit card though, or is it a?
It's the same,
real
you know,
money?
Debit and real money. So I get all of my teaching and writing, everything that goes through my ABN, is paid into that account.
Yeah,
and I try and buy everything to do with my what I now realize are my two businesses, my teaching and my writing.
Are they connected businesses?
They're connected, but they're two different things, apparently.
Oh, really?
We shouldn't do a disclaimer that says we're talking about tax in the way that you guys love us chatting to each other about being candid about the way we stumble through our lives.
80% true.
What's that thing that they do on the radio where they say, for actual tax advice, you should seek a certified accountant? But that's how I do it. So I have one spreadsheet. Now that I've gone to a new fancy new accountant, I have their spreadsheet to put my income into. And they did say, you know, if you catch up and you actually put your expenses in there as you go, that will make life easier.
They do say but that makes life a lot easier.
Who does that? I mean,
well, I was doing that. That was a good downtime activity when I was in the States for my research trip because I was accumulating a lot of receipts.
Yeah, okay. So you were just putting them in, which I think is what the app does. Like you take a photo and then you like swipe left, swipe right, kind of like.
So what's the app? What's the app called?
I don't know. Listen to the Pineapple Project. This season is all about tidying, and it must be like ABC will tell us. It's season 4 or 5 or something. It's about tidying your study up.
That's perfect.
Yeah. So that's what I do. I spend a lot of money. And can I say that the year before last, I think we've talked about this, I earned, when I took out my deductions, I earned $6.
Wow.
Because, you know, that was including like my retreats. That was the year that I went on the sailing trip or whatever, like everything against my earnings. And
that's where you ended
up. Grand total
is that
of $6.
The red or the black?
That's the black. $6 was in the black. I was in the black by $6. What do you do, Catherine? Tell me. Come on, you're an engineer.
No, I don't. I was hoping you might have a better, like you might have something that I could adopt.
Well, the different card, like, that's an easy is excellent one. Because that's what I was saying. I don't actually use the Spike anymore. I just go through my bank.
Yeah. I collect receipts in my wallet.
Yep.
And then I end up throwing some of them out, not realizing they're receipts.
Yeah.
Now I've instigated a Ziploc bag that I just put everything in the Ziploc
bag. Hang on, where does the Ziploc bag live?
The Ziploc bag is in our study.
Okay.
Which is just, it's not really a study. It's just everything lives in.
And then what about then all your
And then I have a spreadsheet.
Emailed ones.
All my emailed ones.
For instance, if you were just rejoining Writers Victoria at the moment, because it's obviously their subscriber-thon.
It's so subscriber-thon. Complicated.
Yeah,
so
where do you put those ones?
So I have a spreadsheet from the previous year, and then I did Barefoot Investor, which means I have 10,000 bank accounts.
Yes. See, I only got up to the bit where you make the bank accounts, and then it was too much.
That's about as far as we got.
Yeah.
So we have all of it, because we had existing bank accounts, and then we swapped to the five bank accounts that he says. Anyway, so then I go through each of the bank accounts and try and work out which is it's a stupid system.
Yeah.
Which is an expense, and then try to match it with a receipt. But I was hoping you might have something.
No. I tell you what I would like to know, though. I mean, Mr. Barefoot Investor, who sold like a gazillion billion copies, I wonder how many people only got up to making the dates and making the bank accounts.
Because he says he makes it sound so easy, quick date, go out for dinner with your partner. But the amount of work involved in each of those steps is not just the tiny little bit that's done at the date.
I fell asleep before the passwords came through for the new bank accounts, and then I was done.
Insurance takes like a 6-month process.
Yeah.
Now, the other thing that is less about the receipt stuff is how you actually, like doing the, you know, how you set up and do the tax return.
Yes.
Most people would know that there's income averaging for creative industries.
Do you think most people do know? I don't think people do. I've got an awesome article that we're going to link to that's about income averaging.
Yeah.
Because I think unless you're working with an accountant,
that's
maybe
true.
People don't know
you
about income
know if
averaging.
You weren't working with
Can
an
you
accountant.
Explain
that's
it?
True. So basically, I guess it is premised on the idea that if you're in creative industries, chances are you'll get a big lot of money 1 year.
Yeah.
And then you might have a couple of years where you get nothing. So
this
it's just
article
a
describes it as
out.
Lumpy income.
Ah, that's
and
a
I
very
like
good
that.
Way to
yeah,
put it.
Yeah, that's cool. If you have a lumpy income. So 1 year, you're flush.
So, for example, when I got the advance for the helpline, I had never put in a tax return that had talked about any writing whatsoever.
Yeah, right.
So my accountant redid the previous year's tax return and then did that year's tax return. And then that happened again this year.
Yeah.
They had to redo last year's and do this year's. But then this year, which may be relevant, depending on the size of the advance that people get from this financial year, I actually have a trust set up.
Yeah, you went all the way through to the trust. I like it.
So Jacinta had recommended an accounting firm. Are you now using?
I am.
Yeah, who are really good. So they specialize in creative types.
We will put a link.
Have you gone in there?
Yeah, that's very cool.
It's really cool. It's sort of a warehousey vibe. Yeah,
it makes you feel like you're a rock star.
Absolutely.
Basically. I think there maybe was a rock star in there when I went in there.
I felt the same way because I was sitting there in the waiting area, and maybe they just do this for everyone, but the guy that owns it was having a very loud conversation mentioning like people from the D generation, like Rob Stitch, Sandhood.
Yeah,
like,
same, or, I reckon.
Yeah,
same.
Right.
Maybe it's a policy.
So they just do like play
Or maybe they're just
play.
Very good at what they do and everyone is represented by them.
But they're very good. So they had suggested that was their advice.
Yeah. I think what's great is working with people who understand the creative industries, who can say, like whoever told me that my books were deductible, I spend like what I put it out on Twitter, something like $3,500 a year on books, right?
Yeah.
Silly. That's why I only have a $6 profit in the end once I add everything else in. But whoever told me that first time, that's part of your work. Like that's part of what you're doing. And what I love is that my first accountant, with delightful and extraordinary optimism and faith in me, started doing that idea of me putting the deductions against my writing, kind of like before I'd really earned anything.
Yeah.
You know, and so that's what you need.
That's a lot of faith. Mm. Yeah. So the trust, I don't really know a lot about the trust, but essentially you assign the copyright of your work to the trust and then you get paid by the trust.
Yeah. Talk to the it's so complicated, but when they didn't make it sound complicated when they explained it.
Well, I think they do it all the time.
Yeah, I think it's deeply impressive, and I just hope that it makes
maybe you'll get $9 back.
Yeah,
next
maybe
year.
I'll get
your money and get
$12 back. But I think what's important is also for people just to realize that all those subscriptions, all those tickets. So if you're going to writers' festivals, if you're going to events, that kind of stuff, that is, you put those as deductions, that they are part of your work.
There are weird rules though, because we can't claim all of this podcast.
Oh, no, I don't even know. I mean, who knows what the podcast is? A big, what do they say about, there's something about sailing. My friend, when I was doing research for the book, said that yachties talk about that it's better just to take your cash into the shower and just like shove it down the shower hole instead of actually investing it in your yacht, because that's kind of what it's like.
That is actually one thing I have that is unrelated to writing, but I have this, I hope it's good. It's called Raise, used to be called Acorns. It's an app and you link it to the 5,000 bank accounts that you have through Barefoot Investor.
Yeah.
And it does roundups for you. So every time you spend $1.24,
yeah,
it rounds it up to the nearest dollar and puts it in this account and then it invests it for you. Oh my God. I've been doing it for 4 weeks. I've already got $100.
What?
Yeah.
What is this thing?
Yeah.
Okay, can you set up on my phone?
Yeah. It's amazing. It's really good. R-A-I-Z, Raise.
Okay. That's good. I think we should close out the conversation too about tax, because it's ultimately, you know, about money and profit too, isn't it? Is to say that the other thing that we have in the creative industries, and it's like when we talk about this podcast, is that some things you do... Most things you do, in fact, are never actually going to equal out in terms of time invested and money.
You could have busked for $6.
Oh, totally. I mean, I could have done a lot of things for $6, for more than $6, let's face it. So, I do think that there's this beauty in talking about it and like treating it as a profession. This is our business. Let's make it, let's put my receipts there. But if you're looking at the bottom line, if I was looking at that $6 and, you know, my partner was and our family was and we had to make a decision on that, obviously the decision would have been, dude, you can't do that anymore. Sorry. But in these creative industries.
It would be pretty difficult. I mean, there's probably only 20 or something full-time writers in Australia. Oh, I'm always struck by people's naivety. People will often say to me, so are you writing full-time now?
Yeah, yeah. Because clearly you're loaded. Because this publishing deal,
be really challenging to have, and it would be very challenging creatively to have to do that.
Yeah, absolutely. And we've talked about that. What do we say? Income transparency, is that it? Like I can do it because I've done it this far because my partner supported, and you know, hopefully I can do a little bit back the other way at some point. Tax, sexy tax. Can you please, people out there, let us know your hacks for how you do your tax?
That'd be great.
Awesome.
Will Kostakis is a writer of all things, from celebrity news stories that score cease and desist letters to tweets for professional wrestlers. That said, he's best known for his award-winning YA novels. His first novel, Loathing Lola, was released when he was just 19. His second, The First Third, won the 2014 Gold Inky Award. The Sidekicks was his third novel for young adults and his American debut. As a high school student, Will won the Sydney Morning Herald Young Writer of the Year for a collection of short stories. He has now made his first foray into fantasy with Monuments, released in September this year. Welcome, Will.
Well, thanks so much for having me.
Now, we're going to get into books, but first of all, I want to find out about tweets for professional wrestlers.
Okay, so I used to manage sort of web content for Channel 9's sort of reality TV shows. So I wrote a book making fun of reality TV, and then the only job I got in journalism was writing for a reality TV show. So that I just
sort
wished
of
it into I spoke it into existence. And so I was writing for The Block, Celebrity Apprentice, The Voice, and Big Brother. And then my boss left and I was about to release the first third. So I was like, okay, bye. And she went off to the US and worked for WWE, and they needed somebody to help ghostwrite some tweets for wrestlers whenever they'd visit Australia, or to write the content for their Australian arm. And it was fascinating because no matter what I wrote, it would always get sent back by these people in Connecticut saying, this doesn't sound Australian enough. So
really?
I literally have to write like a Cap and Kim side character.
Yeah.
So I was just like, g'day, mate, Struth. You know, these blokes are coming, you know. And then everyone would just rip into me in the comments. And I'm just like, told you. Like, it was, look, the things we do for money. And that was... It's too recent, like like it wasn't like something I did when I was starting out as an author. It was recent past, so I'm glad that chapter's over. It was fascinating. I learned a lot, and it really motivated me to just be good at this author thing because I don't want to have to do those sort of.
Oh, that makes perfect sense. So let's start at the beginning.
Yeah,
obviously you were published when you were first published when you were very young.
A child, yeah.
Well, you got the book deal as a non-adult.
And it's like,
I'm 17 years old.
I mean, I'm in two camps about it. Part of me is like, hell yeah, like I got the book deal when I was 17. But the other part of me was like, I was so not ready for it.
Right.
And publishers are not equipped to handle like child egos. Like where you, like the way the editorial process works is you deal with someone almost, especially at the end of the process, almost every day. You're bouncing things back and forth. And then when the book is done, it's like, okay, bye. And you're immediately shut off from them.
Yeah.
And that for me was something that was really difficult to come to terms with. And there were no real support networks. And then it was just like, oh, your book hasn't really sold.
Yeah.
Lucky you're doing that journalism degree, because journalism's going to be around forever. That's one of those careers that's not in the tank. And so I went back to uni, or stayed at uni rather, and finished off my degree. But it was just like, there was no real support. I went from being their like child star, at least in the editorial process, to then being a number on a spreadsheet. And when that number underwhelms, there was no one there to catch me. And that's why I always am very apprehensive, probably not the right word, but I'm always just, I feel something in my guts whenever I see a publisher has either signed someone who's quite young or is publishing someone who's quite young, because I'm like, they're not ready. And the industry itself, as much as I love it, it is not equipped to handle children.
Wow, that's a story. I guess because you're a minority getting published at that age.
Yeah.
So that's really not a story or a side of it that you hear very often.
No, and it's that.
So has writing always been a part of your life?
Yeah, I remember in year one, my teacher gave me a merit certificate at the end of the year for excellence in creative writing, which I don't understand. Like, no matter how good you are in year one, there's no way you're producing anything that is close to excellence. Maybe I was really passionate about it. I wanted to be Enid Blyton before I knew about all the racism.
Yes, Enid Blyton has had a plummet in...
Yeah, that's a thing.
Acceptability, isn't she?
And so, but I was writing all the way through primary school, and then from year seven onwards, I was sending out manuscripts to publishers. I wasn't telling them my age because I was like, I want to be published because of how good I am. And the words on the page, they were getting these really creepy sort of, you could see them imagining, oh, there's this weird old man who's writing these really inappropriate stories. But whereas I was a 12-year-old going, I'm going to say so many rude things, and because this is how teenagers speak.
The genre was always YA.
It was YA, and it was, but it was always just really shocking. And it was just every inappropriate thing I ever heard at school. And every horrid story went into it. And there's like, I've since learnt that there's realism and then there's acceptable realism. And this was firmly not in the acceptable camp. But when I pitched the novel when I was in year 12, I wrote my age, and that was the book that got me a book deal.
Yeah.
And so while I would love to say that it's my raw talent that got me published, it was me stating my age, and that's how marketable I am.
You're too hard on yourself.
Yeah, but it's like, I'm sure there was some talent there, and there are some like parts of that book that I'm still really proud of, and it's still, but it's definitely nowhere near the book that I wrote when I was 21, 22.
Yeah.
So there was that huge growth. And so that's why I always say, whenever a student comes up to me going, I want to be an author and I want to be an author now, I'm like, breathe, wait, relax. The book you write in 5 years is going to be so much better, and you're going to know what you want to write. So just have fun with being a writer. In an ideal world, publishers would get you to write that first book with them, grow with them for 2 years, and then shelve it. And then, you know, get it, go set a watch menu in a few years and be like, oh, they're in a nursing home. Here's that first book, you know. But allowing them to sort of grow, find their voice, and then write that proper first book.
So you must have had the drive to be published fairly early on.
Yeah.
What, because it's a pretty unusual thing to do. To write would be one thing, but to actually then take the steps to send manuscripts to publishers. Where did that come from? Was that...
Look, I would always
by writers, or?
Not at all. Mum doesn't know where it came from. Dad wasn't there, so I can't ask him. But I'd always look at the back of Morris Gleitzman books and be like, oh, I'm going to be on the back. It would say 40-year-old author, Morris Gleitzman. I'd be like, nah, I'm going to be 10-year-old author. And then every year I'd reimagine 11-year-old, 12-year-old, to the point where when I was published at 17, I'm like, oh, I'm too late. Like, I wanted to be published so much earlier. And the big drive for me was, yes, I was writing and sharing my stories with friends over MSN Messenger, if people remember that from back in the day. But the big thing was, look, when my parents split up, it was a really, it was not a great divorce. And Dad ran off to start another family because he was so good at the first one. But like, we were living in a shell of a house that was half renovated. Mum was working 80 hours a week to sort of get us through school. And... you know, it got to the point where one day she came home from work and I distinctly remember seeing her collapse up the stairs. And my older brother had been looking after us. He was, what, 11, I was 9, younger brother was 7. And I remember when she came to, her response wasn't, oh, okay, this is bad, I need to slow down. Her response was, oh, this is bad, the kids need to live with their grandmother while I do this to myself to get them through school. Wow. And so there was always a part of me that was like, I'm going to write this book and it's going to make a ton of money and it's going to be a bestseller and Mum won't have to work so hard. And
wow, that's huge for then a child of that age.
When I got the deal at 17, I'm like, oh, I'm too late. You know, I'm finishing high school. Like, I didn't, you know, obviously as an adult now I see, one, Mum was perfectly capable of, you know, she's incredibly strong and she could do all of that herself. She didn't need a preteen to save her. But I was really hard on myself for quite a while thinking, oh, I hadn't done it fast enough. And then when the book came out and it failed, I was like, oh, I didn't do that well enough. You know, when there are so many other things that, you know, come into play with a book's success.
So that first time must have been, I mean, you said earlier, there's not a lot of support for someone so young.
Mm-hmm.
What was, in a practical sense, that first experience like? Did you do book tours? Did you?
I did. I was literally thrown into a plane, gone, you're speaking at a Byron Bay Writers Festival, like immediately straight off the bat. No briefing on how to speak to media or anything like that. And then before the festival, thrown into my first TV interview.
Wow.
Which I now look back at, I've still got it on YouTube and it's terrible. And I look like I was dressed by my grandmother. But it was just like, I was so bold and brazen and no one had sort of taught me how to speak about a book or what I needed to get across. And then from that into, you know, literary panels at Byron Bay Writers Festival.
Who was on your first panel with you? Do you remember?
My first panel was actually cancelled because of the weather. I was supposed to be on a Young Lions of Literature panel with Naam Lee.
Oh,
and
wow.
That got cancelled and I never met Naam. second panel, I don't remember. I remember there was a guy who kept talking about his process and he reeked of bourbon. And now I've come to realise that some authors, usually the adult authors, treat writers' festivals as excuses just to get absolutely obliterated behind the scenes and then turn up reeking of a hangover. And that was always something I was like, oh, you're not taking this as seriously as me. That's why I'm going to be a star.
So did you take it seriously?
Oh, hell yeah. Yeah. It was, it's, and even to this day, I don't drink when I tour. I don't, like, I am very sort of disciplined in that regard. And, you know, my body doesn't help me out. Like, if I drink the night before I'm supposed to speak, I won't have a voice the next day.
Right.
Like one or two drinks and it's gone. So I'm like, look, if a big part of my identity as an author is speaking, I'm not one of those authors who gets hand-sold vigorously in bookstores. Or at least a big part of, you know, my identity is getting out there, speaking, then building a brand that way, or at least it was at the very beginning.
So how did you discover that that would work better for you?
I realized that, 2 months after the book came out, I was no longer in stores.
Right.
And I was like, okay, what do I do here? How do I sell this book that is in a warehouse? And I was like, okay, school visits. Like, it was no one at the pub. Again, I hadn't been prepped. No one at the publisher had told me about school visits, let alone told me, hey, this is a way you can actually make money as a writer. And so I was like, okay, school visits. I had no reputation as a speaker. So I'm like, okay, how do I do this? Even my old high school didn't really want to have me back, like, immediately.
Wow.
So it was just, but it was just like, that's it. Like, why are you going to get, like, school curriculums are so crammed. Why are you going to let, an old boy at a prestigious, like, high school take up the time of students for 40 minutes if you don't know that they can speak? So I needed to build a reputation before I could. And so I sent out just emails to absolutely any school librarian that I could sort of guess the email address of. And I was lucky enough, there was one school, Bankstown Girls High School, and they got me in without any reputation at all. And I had a box of books, and that box of books was empty by the end of the day. And I was like, right, okay.
You sold the books?
Sold the books, yeah.
Wow.
So I was like, okay, this is a thing. I am in front of teens. I wasn't getting paid for the gig, but I was like, yeah, I can sell books. Like, I can talk about myself for 2 hours and get teenagers excited and get them to want to read my work. And so
would you talk about the process of writing in those?
Spoke about the process of writing, spoke about how I came to write that book. And then because I'd only just written my first book, there was a lot of talking to them about what they liked and letting them sort of govern the discussion, or at least steer the discussion, and talk about their interests and what they're writing. And then it melded into sort of creative writing advice, giving workshops, things like that. But that librarian was so impressed, she told two other librarians, who then each told two others. And
wow.
That was my apprenticeship year. So I went from school to school speaking for free, building up my sort of skill set as a speaker. And then once I was sure, okay, this is a product in its own right, then I started charging. So, and that's a big thing that you find now, school budgets are shrinking and speaker fees are quite expensive. And you have people who are like, okay, I've written a book, therefore I can command this rate. And while it's really important that we stick to the sort of guidelines of the union and not sort of, charge less for particular gigs, we've also got to remember that just because you've written a book doesn't mean that you're an engaging speaker. And I would recommend anyone who is at least starting out, give yourself 10 school visits that you do for free at first to figure out, one, if this is for you, because a lot of authors do it and like, this is a layer of hell and this saps my energy. Yeah. Whereas when I speak, I'm invigorated and I'm like, okay, I understand my audience a little bit better. And it keeps my novels current and it's become a part of my process. But I know for a lot of people, it's not. But so give yourself those 10 school visits to sort of figure out if you're good at it. Try to sell some books if you can. Then if you're good at it, then that helps make the writing books for a living thing a little more viable.
So is that how you support your writing now? Yeah. Is largely
That's
through
it.
School
So
visits.
There's no more journalism. It's just school visits.
Wow. And so how many school visits would you do in any 12-month period?
Over 200.
Right.
So it is exhausting.
And do they vary a lot in the
they
form
vary.
Of them?
So some of them may be going to a school for a lunchtime. Some of them may be going to a school for speaking for four periods, even though I'm usually like three is my max. Then, surprise, here's a fourth. Either giving full year-level addresses, assembly addresses, one-on-one with students who are doing a higher level of English or workshops with classes. I've had teachers come up to me going, hey, you've got year 11, they're studying romanticism, so can you just like give a lecture on romanticism? And I'm like, I don't know anything about romanticism. So, but it's, if you want to get in front of those kids, you've got to jump through the hoop. It's just sometimes the hoop is spinning and on fire.
Wow.
So I've now built up the strength to be like, no, I'm not going to teach your class on romanticism. I'll teach them something generic about creative writing that they can then apply to their sort of studies overall. But having the courage to say that takes time because you don't want to piss off the people who are putting bread on your table. And yeah.
So you've now written four novels.
Yeah.
How has the writing process changed over that time?
I always try to set myself a challenge at the beginning of every book. And that challenge usually dictates how I write the book. So with the first third, it was, okay, Loathing the Law, my first book, you can tell a 17-year-old boy wrote it. It's just boob joke, fart joke, typo. And you know when you're talking to someone and you can feel they're hiding something?
Yep.
And that is like a barrier between you and you can't get through. And you might enjoy their company, but you're not like, oh, I truly know that person. Like there were lots of laughs, but they didn't let me in.
Yep.
That is Loathing Lola in a nutshell. So with the first third, I was like, you know what? I've got to let people in. Plus, if this is going to be my last book because Loathing Lola didn't sell particularly well, I was like, okay.
So you had a 2-book deal?
No, was I that... had, no, no, no. It was just 1 book. And then I had a second chance with a different publisher.
Right.
So I was like, right, okay.
That you had pitched to, or did you
have
an agent?
Yeah, I pitched. No agent yet. So still just pitching and talking and going into meetings and they'd be like, write another 10,000 words. Write another 10,000 words, write another 10,000 words. And it wasn't until I was about 40,000 words in that I was like, okay, you've seen enough, buy the damn thing. And they did. And the challenge that I set myself for that was to be more personal. So I set myself 3 or 4 sort of key sequences that I knew were going to be in the book and an ending that I was working towards. And I let myself find the novel between then and between those points. And when I was finding the novel and when I was meandering, I didn't have anything planned. That's when I wrote the most special, the most personal things. So I was like, okay, cool. I went into the sidekicks thinking, okay, I want to write a story that really has a strong voice. That was my challenge. I wanted 3 distinct voices because the first third, it's great, but it sounds like me on Twitter. So I was like, okay, how do I do this? The first third had, you know, those points where I made things up as I went along and they had the strongest, most personal voice. So I'm like, great, I'm going to write the sidekicks with no plan and I'm going to see where I go. That was terrifying. And I realized that completely getting rid of all of the safety rails, I was meandering and I just couldn't do it. And I had to go back and rewrite it several times. And then once I had a structure, then I could write the thing.
Right.
So that was
Loathing Lola had a structure to begin with.
That was really plotted, like to the point where it felt like I was just checking things off a checklist and it didn't have that sort of soul, which is why I sort of shied away from that with the first
book. It's interesting. People often talk about you'll have 1 book, the next book, you sort of set out with the intent of fixing the problem that was in the, like that is front of mind.
Yeah. And so with Monuments, which is my first fantasy novel, I was like, okay, the challenge is I'm writing fantasy. But I was like, okay, I can't write in a completely new genre and find the book as I go along. That's going to be terrifying. And so what I did was I went back to the first third method where I had 6 or 7 key sequences and I knew where they landed and then let myself find the novel between. And I think it worked really, really well. And I think that's going to be my process going forward.
And so why the shift to fantasy? What drove that?
A couple of things. There is the purely cynical, I want to make money from this angle, which is I'll speak at a school and I'll get kids to laugh at absolutely everything I say. And then when they come up to look at my books, they're like, oh, I don't read contemporary. And so instantly you have someone who is shut off from it. So I'm like, okay, I'm never going to reach this reader. Like I could probably sit there and read it to them and make it funny, but they're not coming to it, you know. And I see that in every single school in the country. I see fantasy novels are speaking to teenagers in a way that realism isn't. And you look at the sales data and it supports that. But it's usually the big American fantasy novels that are cutting through. And so there was that. So that's the sort of cynical business model sort of side of things. I wanted a book where if someone came up to me and they were like, I want a really sad book about grief. And I'm like, great, I have this book for you. Another kid, I want to go on an adventure. Great, I have this book for you. So it was something for different tastes. I don't want to keep writing the same book. I know publishers want you to write the same book over and over, but I think that I can write a Wilkes Starkus book that feels like a Wilkes Starkus book that isn't a carbon copy of the plotline of the book before it. And so there was that part of it. But then also, I'm a big fantasy reader. I grew up reading Terry Pratchett. He was my favorite author. And then when I say that at schools and they read my work, they're like, where is Terry's influence here? And I'm like, oh, it's there in the sex jokes that I cut out 2 days before release. Like, but besides that, it's not really there. And so I used to disappear into fantasy worlds as a kid. And that was something I really wanted to do. And I was in a position in my career where I was coming off the critical success and commercial success of The Sidekicks, where I could go, okay, what do I want to do? I didn't want to write another grief book. I couldn't do it. Like after the first third in The Sidekicks, I was exhausted. Mm. And I was like, okay, what can I do? I started writing something fun just for me. And then very quickly I realized that fun thing just for me was something that could probably turn into another book. And by the time I committed to it, when I was like 5,000 words in, I was like, no, this is something special.
And so the publication process of the mm-hmm. Monuments, you have mm-hmm. had different publishers yes. the way through.
Yeah.
What was the process for getting a publisher for this one? Have you ever had an agent, for example?
So Monuments was my first agent at work.
Yep.
And so I was like, okay, I want to do this properly. I want to see, is the grass greener elsewhere? I had a long and fruitful career with Penguin and it was going really well, but I could, you know, when you can tell that just you're telling someone the idea for something and they're just not, they don't quite get it or they're not as passionate about it as you are. And I was like, okay, that's not ideal. And I'm sure, you know, their big question was, why have you written a fun page turner? And that question was asked as a negative.
Yep. Yeah.
And
right.
I'm like, okay, I can't wallow in grief. At least I need a 2 book break. And then I can come back and we can have as much grief as you want. But I am having nightmares about my best friend that died in high school and nightmares about my grandmother dying. Like, I can't, for my sanity, keep mining these sort of personal wells. You know, for me to walk into schools and have kids say, I won't read that because it's not fantasy. Or have me walk into a school of an audience of 300 people and say, does anyone know who I am? And have no one put up their hand. And, you know, I can do that and it's fulfilling in a sort of personal sense. But at some point, I have to walk out onto the plate and try to hit a home run. And I knew that something that combined the way that I spoke at school, sort of this sort of funny, light voice, but with some serious meat underneath. Like if I put that into a fantasy novel that felt super Australian, that filled that gap in the market, you know, in the, you know, year 7, year 8 block where we don't have books, younger YA targeted directly to them. And we don't have fantasy novels that are unashamedly Australian or if we do have them, they never rise to the top and they're never given the credit that they deserve. I was like, that's a gap in the market and I want to try hit that.
And so how did you go about building the world?
It was something that was built slowly over several years. I knew I wanted to see the clash between the real and the fantastical. Like my favorite parts of the final Harry Potter books were when you saw real world London clash with the magical world. And my favorite parts of the Matrix film were seeing the Sydney that was fictional and seeing the sort of fantastical stuff that would happen within it. So I knew I wanted a fantasy world that was my Sydney. And that was it. So I knew they weren't going to go somewhere else, somewhere magical. And that was something that I started with. And I was like, okay, cool. What am I going to work with here? And I knew I wanted a lore and myths that were completely new and they were detached from sort of ancient Greek sort of society because I didn't want to be, hey, I'm the Greek author who's written the ancient Greek god books. Like, and, you know, they've been done far better by people who are much better writers than me. And so, and I don't really have that passion for ancient history that they would. So I wanted to take the ordinary and make it extraordinary in a really different way. And so I took cues from my favorite. I mapped it out like it was a video game. Like to start with, I was like, okay, what's the mission going to be first and foremost? And the world and the lore came from that. And so for me, a big influence was Legend of Zelda, which is okay, or at least the 3D incarnations that I've played, you know, Link, who's the main character, he wears the green tunic and has the sword. He wanders into a temple or a dungeon of some kind solves a series of puzzles, defeats a boss, collects an item, collects six or seven items, saves the world. And I was like, okay, I'm doing a glorified Fetchem quest. Like, this is a video game. And so I'm like, okay, what are going to be my temples? And so for me, I was visiting schools every day of the week, speaking at different schools and seeing the wide disparity between the uber wealthy schools and the schools that had, you know, 300 kids huddled around one broken air conditioning unit. And I'm like, okay, schools are going to be the hub. Or, you know, they're going to be visiting different schools around Sydney and you're going to see that disparity. And so I was like, okay, there's something buried beneath those schools. Okay, what can be buried under there? And I wanted powerful beings. And I was like, okay, let's go with gods. And so that's where I sort of started in my head. That was the thought process. And I'm like, okay, we've got to find a reason to get him to find all of these gods under different schools. You know, what is the, you know, ticking clock? Like, why is he doing this? Are there people hunting them? Yes, there are people hunting the gods. Okay, why are they hunting the gods? Because if you kill a god, you get their power. And I'm like, great. So I had that sort of in my head. And at the same time, I was visiting all these schools and watching the news. And I'm thinking, right, I will spend a day at a school and I will have my heart warmed by kids in LGBTQI plus sort of Rainbow Alliance groups who are supporting their classmates. I will see kids who are speaking passionately about climate change or about, you know, accommodating refugees and embracing them in the school community. And they speak with such hope for the future that you can't help but feel inspired. And then I'd go home or I'd be on the train and I'd look at Twitter and it'd just be like, politician had said something obviously racist, but we're going to report it as if it's fact. And I'd just be like, every adult in the world is letting everyone down. And I thought, okay, what if teens had the power to change the world? Because look, teens, they have the numbers, but they don't have the power unless they seize it. Because look, for a teenager, if I meet one inspiring teenager at a school, for them to become prime minister, what do they have to do? They have to charm the local office of the Liberals or Labour. They have to get pre-selected. So it means they have to wait their turn. So they're 5 or 6 years older now. Then they have to win an election. Yeah, win the seat. Then they have to, what else do they have to do? They have to charm their party to eventually become leader of it. They have to pay their dues over the years. So by this time, they have probably been corrupted and they've been aged another 10 years. And then they have to win the party leadership, usually by backstabbing someone. And then eventually, they can become prime minister if they win an election.
Yep.
Yep. And if they become prime minister without the election, they have to go to the election, win the election to then have the perceived mandate. And, you know, our whole system of power is so weighted in the favor of older people who aren't going to live in the world that they're shaping. And they have been in that political system so long that they don't even know what the real world looks like anymore. And so I was like, okay, I need a sudden way for teenagers who are pretty fed up with their lot in life to suddenly have power.
Mm.
And
which is very appealing to teenagers too, isn't it?
And so you get them absorbing the powers of the gods. And so that's when my sort of thematic sort of concept merged with the world that I was building. And then it clashed together and then the book was sort of made.
And so do you do that thinking up front? I mean, I know you talked about having sort of key sequences or events.
I have sort of ideas of it up front, but it really sort of comes to life as I'm writing it. And about halfway through, I'm like, this is it. And then I'll go back and restart.
Yeah. You'll get to the halfway point and then
go back. Yeah, yeah, and rejig. But yeah, so that's my process.
On the subject of school visits,
2016. Oh, hey, my favorite year. Absolutely nothing happened to me.
So you had an event at a Catholic school that got cancelled.
So what happened was I knew that book sales were usually tied to my school visits and events. So I'm like, great, I've got a new book coming out. I'm going to email the schools that were really kind to me last year and be like, okay, would you like to have me back? To do a book launch style thing where I'll speak to a cohort and then sign books afterwards. And
Has that become part of your standard process to re-email the schools that you've been to?
If a new book is coming out, there'll be like a handful of them that'll be like, okay, cool, you were really great. that didn't feel like work. Your students were really inspiring. And they had accepted my invitation without having read the book. And that was fine because they knew the sort of content that I wrote and they'd read my previous work. And all the while, sort of in my head, I was like, okay, cool. I have written a book. You know, writing the sidekicks helped me come out to my family and friends. And so it was, that process was incredibly healing. And it was a book about, you know, discovering who you are, embracing that and not being ashamed to say it. And yet I was assumed heterosexual. And, you know, I was getting away with that because I hadn't sort of stated it. And I was feeling a bit uncomfortable about that, but I'm like, no, I don't want to stuff up my chances with this book, so I'm going to stay mum. And then my first partner, who wasn't my partner any longer, but we were still close friends, he was diagnosed with testicular cancer. And he was like, oh, yeah, no, I'm all fine. But before we do any treatments or anything, I have to go to a sperm bank and deposit some swimmers. And because I had a car, he asked me to drive him. And so we had our little Thelma and Louise sort of road trip across Sydney, but it was Will and his ex go to the sperm bank. And so I did that. And as I was driving him, I was like, wow, you know what? I had written the sidekicks about me not being as good a friend as I could have been to my friend before he passed away. And yet here I was not being a good a person, whether it be partner or friend to my ex. And I was only realizing that when his health was threatened. And you're supposed to learn these life lessons once. I didn't want to keep learning that life lesson where, you know, oh, someone's dying. Hey, time to be good to them. And I was like, okay, the big thing that I'd done to him was I diminished his value in my life. Like whenever someone saw us when we were out together, oh, this wasn't my partner, this was my close friend. And that slowly sort of chips away. And that definitely chipped away at our relationship. And I couldn't do that to him. And I didn't want to do that to somebody else. And I was like, you know what? I'm going to come out publicly. And so my friend worked for an online publication that specialized in gay content. So I was like, I'll write my coming out for them. And I wrote about how when you're gay and in the closet, you have a lot of close friends. You never have partners, you have close friends. And so I was writing about sort of the weight of the close friendships. And they rejected that article because it wasn't gay enough, because I hadn't said the word gay. And I was like, okay, so I can either gay it up or I come out on my terms. And I decided to come out on my terms on my website. A whopping 4 people read it. One of those people was a librarian at this school who now sort of, it was too gay for her. Well, look, I understand it where, you know, there are these schools. It's not on her. It's about the culture of the school. And this was during the beginning of the plebiscite debate when we were umming and ahhing about doing a postal vote and things like that. And so everything was hyper political. And so I knew that it was a power keg for them and they didn't want this to be an issue. And so it was just like, words to the effect of, this is no longer appropriate for year sevens and we can't let you come in not having read your book. But they had let me in. They had accepted my sort of request before having read it, and they knew they wouldn't have the chance to read it beforehand. But because I was gay, suddenly they were afraid of the content in my book. Forgetting that I'd spoken at that school about the first third, where one of the prominent subplots was the character who is dealing with the intersection of his disability and his sexuality and sort of how to navigate the Sydney scene as a young gay boy with a disability. And they were fine with that. But that was when I was a straight man, and straight people writing gay stories is always, 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 always more accepted. And you look at the big gay stories that we celebrate in Australia, besides Christos Solkus, they're usually written by straight women. And that's really interesting because it bucks the trend of own voices and what we're looking for in diverse stories. And it's because we deem it as safer because, you know, gay men, we're always out for the convert. You know, it's not. And so, you know, I got that letter and I remember coming out of a school visit I'd done that day that was really, really great. And it was just before my book launched that night. And I had 4 missed calls, 3 from my speaker's agent and 1 from the school. And I called back the speaker's agent after I'd read an email that had said that. And their main priority was making sure that I didn't stuff up the school's relationship with them because they would like to send another author in my place.
Wow.
And I was like, okay, I'm literally just your $70 booking fee. Like, I'm not a person. Like, they said all the right things, but that was what they built towards.
It's devastating.
And I was like, nah. And I thought, you know what? I've spent the past 8 years touring schools. Everyone knows exactly what I do when I visit schools. I have this reputation. Like, this is, I'm one of the most prolific tourers in the country. You know what I do. And you know what I do is appropriate. And so I put my, I wrote, they, my books, my speaker's agent was like, Will, would you like us to reply for you? And I'm like, no, this has to come from me. And so I sent them an email back. And then I was like, okay, if this is how people are going to react to me being gay, they're going to send me emails really delicately worded and they're going to cancel my events. I need to put this online and scare the living crap out of everyone so that no one else tries this. Because if I leave it in silence, it's going to keep happening. And so I put it online. I redacted the school's name. And I was like, if you're considering sending me this email, don't. And once I put that online,
put it on your website, put it on my website. Online?
And that was when everyone went back and realized, oh, Will's gay. And because they'd missed the first post. And then that post got picked up very quickly. And then I was talking to my publisher. My publisher called me. So the woman who worked in marketing was like, okay, I just saw your post. Are you okay? I'm like, yeah, I'm okay. She's like, this could be a thing. And I'm like, what do you mean? She's like, I could send it to some people and it could be a thing. But have you told everyone that you're gay? And are you comfortable with this being a thing? Because this will be a thing for about a week. And I'm like, oh, I didn't know. And I was just like, but I kept going back to what would 13, 14, 15, 16-year-old Will, who was, you know, sitting in bed at night just wishing to be straight, want me to do. And, you know, and I was like, make it a thing, whatever. I'll talk about it with some people. She's like, okay, cool. I know some people. And I had interviews.
That is a hard decision.
Yeah. And it was, and I was like, oh, okay. And I remember texting my mom going, hey, I'm going to be national news-ish, but just, it's okay. And we just won't tell, my grandmother, what I'm national news about. That was before I'd come out to her. And from the moment it went live, I couldn't use my phone for 3 days.
Wow.
It was constantly vibrating, constantly. Like, I was getting emails from people in France. I was getting emails from American authors, gay, straight. I was...
In support.
In support. Yep. There was, of the 1,200 emails that I received, wow, one of them was negative, and it was written with very poor grammar, and it was clearly someone who had struggled with their own identity and who had just sort of... was sort of projecting. And I was like, okay, you do you. But the big thing was, everyone thinks, okay, Will got a huge publicity boost. That's it. His book was successful. The book was no longer deemed appropriate for Catholic schools.
Wow.
It was put in the adults only section of a lot of even secular libraries because of, you look at how much power Catholic schools have, what they deem appropriate leaks into syllabuses everywhere. And
so how long had the book been out at that point?
The book launch was that night.
Right. Okay. So
it was like literally they were unboxing it.
Yeah.
And you know, I had to really fight for not only, you know, the book, I had to fight for myself because other schools canceled. I had publicly shamed Catholic schools and their revenge was swift and silent. And it's something I don't usually talk about because I don't want to give it oxygen. But of the next 30 schools I had booked, those bookings became 6.
Wow.
And I completely lost my confidence because I'd started to believe, hey, maybe I'm not appropriate. And I remember like going to speak at the first school afterwards. Like, I didn't say I was gay or anything and my voice would just shake uncontrollably. And I was really lucky to have librarians who had my back. And, you know, a lot of them didn't, a few of them did. And then eventually they wrote supportive sort of comments for me in Facebook groups and that got around and other schools started booking me again. And it took me about a year and a half to be touring as much as I had been before, which is the opposite to what happens when you release a new book. Usually everyone's like, whoosh, we want you to come in. And there were crickets. So that was a horrible experience, but I get it in the political climate. I would have no time for that now because, like, we're past it. The plebiscite issue has been resolved.
Do you think that it was a heightened political climate?
Oh, yeah. Definitely. But everyone was always like, oh, it's the culture of my school. Oh, I can't do this. You're part of the school. Change the culture. Like, the standard you walk past is the standard you accept. And, you know, English teachers and librarians were my people at school. And a lot of them let me down. But it's all sort of culminated. I ended up giving a speech about this at the Centre for Youth Literature Reading Matters Conference. And it all sort of came to a head where I was basically like, hey, you let me down, but I love you. But this is why you let me down. And I sort of talked them through sort of how I felt as a teenager and doubted myself and all that. And we've reached a place now where, you know, they have righted those wrongs. And
you feel that they have? That
Yeah, like what happened to me hasn't happened to anyone since.
Yeah.
And content is getting gayer and gayer. So, you know, I feel like we have righted that sort of wrong.
Would you talk about that in schools?
I have some schools that, like, I've been asked today to deliver a speech about this tonight at a Catholic school.
Yeah.
So, you know, and this was usually the sort of thing I'd only do in adults-only addresses.
Yeah.
And now it's becoming, we talk to kids about identity. That is, like, at the center of a lot of school syllabuses. And we talk about, you know, the refugee experience. We talk about migrant experiences. We talk about all these experiences. But when it comes to diverse sexualities or genders, mm-hmm. suddenly we're really scared to talk about identity. When the whole point of identity is taking a peek into someone else's life and realizing that what you share with them is far greater than what sets you apart. And it's about understanding them a little bit better. But we're afraid that, hey, a kid might read a book about a gay person and realize that they are gay too. And that's not me converting them. That is them discovering their truth. And why on earth would you not want to make that process easier for the children in your care? Because I don't want, you know, the self-doubt that I felt from year 5 onwards until I came out in my 20s. Like, what a waste of a life. Like, I went to university as a closeted straight guy. There were so many opportunities I could have embraced at university. You know, in my book tour for my first book, I was making up girlfriends in interviews, or at least changing, having to sort of police my, you know, pronoun use just so that when they asked about partners, I was talking about women. And that sort of self-censoring chips away at you, like having teachers pull you aside and say, hey, don't mention the gay character when you're giving a talk to people in year 10 who have read the book. It's really silly.
Do you think over time you have become more political in what, or more outspoken?
I always say I'm the monster they've made.
Yeah.
I came out without saying the word gay. I had no interest in this shit. Sorry for cussing, but like, this is not what I want to do. Like, I don't want to, like, I'm not particularly great at speaking off the cuff about political issues. That's get me to talk about a text in a room and I can pull it apart and I absolutely relish it. Like, that is what I love doing. But they made me political by making who I am political. Mm. And that was a choice I didn't have. That was just, it was made for me. And so I remember publisher talking to me being like, okay, Will, just remember that you don't want this to be all you are. And part of me is like, yes, I don't want this to be all I am. But also another part of me is like, this is who I am. And it's that sort of tension where, you know, when you're, say, building a life with someone and you have your partner and you have a family, that is a huge part of your life. Or, you know, whatever, you know, I don't want to sort of lean towards monogamy, but like whatever sort of, whatever way you love, the way you express connection with human beings, like that's a huge part of who you are. And locking that away and saying somebody can't talk about it or you can't talk about it too much for fear of it affecting your chances with getting onto syllabuses, with winning awards, you know, it's really interesting. It's something that I still wrestle with. And part of me is like, oh, was that speech too political? And then I remember, wait, I didn't decide that this was political, because the same people who would tell me that not to talk about my identity, not to talk about being gay. They were the same people who 2 years prior were like, tell us another story about your Greek grandmother. And so there were some parts of identity that we are really comfortable with and that aren't political. Yeah. But if Yaya was Muslim,
yeah,
that would be political. But she would still cook too much, be from the same part of the planet, and be the source of the same embarrassing stories. And the thing we have to remember is that we're not the ones who are making these things political. And we need to talk about our human experiences as they are. I remember I was giving a talk in Brisbane. And I went into these thinking, okay, I'm in Brisbane, so I've got to be conservative because they voted for Scott Morrison or whatever. My bias is going into it. And they ended up being my gayest talks ever, like to the point where I was just running around being really sassy. But it was the closest thing to Will Kostakis does drag in boy clothes as you could get. But I remember this girl put up her hand and she was like, Will, I really want to write stuff that's politically incorrect. I'm like, okay. She's like, but I don't want it to affect my chances of being a politician one day. And I'm like, okay. And I'm trying to unpack that. I'm like, what do you mean by politically incorrect? I'm thinking, does she want to like use racist humor? Does she want to write outside of her experience? What is it? She's like, oh no, I want to write about being gay because I'm gay. And I'm like, okay, something to unpack. First of all, there's that sort of the whole idea that political correctness exists when it's really just respecting other people have different lived experiences, and if they tell you not to say or do something, don't do it because you're being an asshole. Like, that's political correctness in a nutshell. And, you know, I embrace being respectful of other people's experiences. But she had interpreted writing about her lived truth as something that would affect her ability to be palatable to a wider range of people when she's older and wants to be a politician. So what does that tell us about the people we expect to go into politics? What does that tell us about our attitudes, even queer people's attitudes to their own experiences, that they see it as society does, as something that is deviant and something that should be kept hidden? You know, all those things happen. And so these politics are being ingested by people. They're being ingested by teenagers. And we need to work against that. And if that means that my work gets called political, so be it. But really, I'm writing stories of the times, and look at the times that we live in. No one can sit there. If you sit there and go, oh, you know, I don't want to be political at the dinner table, well, then you are silently accepting a lot of the stuff that's happening. And, you know, to say you're not political is to be in a position of really great privilege. Because we need to be political at the moment. We are seeing so many injustices being done in our name. And, you know, we need to capture this moment. So it makes sense that our books, our films, our TV shows are political. And yes, it's exhausting. But oh my God, someone needs to do something because we have businesses who are like, oh, this is fine so long as trade is good. And we have banks that, oh, this is fine so long as economic conditions are good. No, like, respecting people who are different, being kind to refugees, things like that shouldn't have to be owned by one political party. Like, that should just be the standard. And yeah, I worry about what we've allowed to become political instead of saying, hey, you know what, weaponizing, you know, trans kids using your bathroom as a political football, which is something that's happened quite recently, you know, and we've imported that shit from the US. Like, that is, you know, and in New South Wales, we're having debates about how bad it is to decriminalize abortion. And it's like, this is a conversation that hasn't happened in my lifetime, and that we are okay with women's right to choose. Like, that is, but we're becoming more and more and more and more and more political, and because no one's speaking up about how ludicrous these conversations are that we're having. So our books need to reflect that ludicrousness.
I'm going to follow that very depthful and important conversation with a really frivolous question.
Yes. What a pivot. I love it. Now I really want to hear it. Okay, let's go.
You were saying that no launch for Monuments.
Mm-hmm.
How come?
I don't know. This is my fourth book and I'm like, okay, people must know who I am and people will want to go and buy it themselves. I think it's sort of been a test for me to see whether just doing, say, a panel at a bookstore is a viable alternative to a launch, and because that's very much the American model and what they do.
Right, a panel with multiple other authors, yeah. sort of. Graham Simsion, who we interviewed on this podcast, yeah. is very believes there's no sales related merit in the book tour as a thing. Is that sort of where you're coming from? That an event doesn't necessarily sell a book?
I'm sure they had a really huge marketing budget and yeah, I think getting into a room, I can tell you where I've sold books. And, yep. you know, I know my book sales last week came primarily from Melbourne Writers Festival and Brisbane Writers Festival.
Yeah.
So being on tour, yes. Sometimes right. you go on tour and you speak at a library and you have six people there. But, you know, if one of those people becomes a fan, then that adds up. And I think there are merits to the book tour and, you know, I see that reflected in my sales.
Yeah.
Because I know when I'm not touring, I know what my sales are. And when I am touring.
So you are very across your sales.
I
by
am
the sounds
very
of.
Across my sales.
Do you get a weekly or a monthly?
I
or
signed up for BookScan.
Right.
Because I was like, I want to see what's happening. Because, you know, I don't want to have that awkward conversation with the publisher.
So,
a lot of publishers are like, oh, we don't want you to know because you'll get distracted. But I come from, you know, digital production and, you know,
but
websites.
Does it affect you, your sales?
No, it doesn't affect what I write or anything like that. It's just like, I just want to know what my number is.
Yeah.
That's it. And I want to know sort of where I am.
And you can then see other people's numbers, can't you?
I actively decide not to.
Right. Okay.
So I'll see where I am on a chart.
Yeah.
But besides that, I'm not sitting there looking up other people. I have no interest in that. And that would be kind of creepy. I just want to know sort of what I'm doing. You know, my mum's saying, but I'm sure this is everyone's mum saying, you know, if you're swimming in a race, if you're looking left and right to see where other people's positions are, you're not running your best race.
Yeah.
If you focus on your stroke and you focus on what you're doing, you're going to hit the wall the fastest.
That is very good advice. Final question. Mm-hmm. The theme for this season is second books.
Okay.
But we could expand it to be subsequent, second and subsequent books.
Or second book in this series because it's got it's a duology and it has its sequel coming out, my first sequel, which is terrifying.
Are you working on the sequel?
Working on it right now, yeah.
Right. Well, maybe will be relevant. Mm-hmm. What advice do you have for authors working on second or sequels? Books, second books or sequels?
Everybody finds it challenging and everybody hates their second book when they start it or has like a really bad experience with it. And acknowledging that, and if it's not everyone, it's a vast majority of people, acknowledging that is freeing.
Yep.
So allow yourself to hate what you've written. Allow yourself to be uncomfortable by the process a second time because it is tainted by the release of the first book or whatever. Allow yourself to feel that imposter syndrome. Allow yourself to feel like you can't match what you wrote before. But your writing is better because of everything you did to write that first book and that editorial process you went through. So just trust that you're improving. And if what you write is garbage, great. It can either be edited or it can be discarded.
That is very good advice. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a blast.
The first time quick five. Will, agented or unagented?
Unagented.
Advance or no advance?
Advance, but small advance.
Overseas territories or ANZ?
ANZ.
Festival invites or no festival invites?
One festival invite.
Do you know how many copies of Loathing Lola sold? You can
yes.
pass on any question. Are you going to tell us?
You want me to tell you? Well, I don't know like the in-store number, but I know that they only printed 3,200 and that was it. Yeah.
That sounds like a lot.
Oh, yeah, but like you make $1.60 per book. I made more at Macca's that year. So is it a lot?
That's a reality check, isn't it? And what is your favourite novel by a debut author?
Oh, that's tricky. The hardest one for last. The Whole Business with Kiffo and the Pitbull by Barry Johnsberg.
You can find the show notes for today's episode on our website, thefirsttimepodcast.com. Get in touch with us via Instagram or Twitter at @thefirsttimepod, or you can leave us a message on the website. Thanks for listening. You've been listening to The First Time Podcast, a podcast about the first and second time you publish a book. We recorded this episode at RMIT University on the traditional land of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. This podcast is produced by Phoebe Ady. The First Time podcast is supported by Writers Victoria, ACT Writers Centre, RMIT School of Media and Communication, and by our wonderful supporters on Patreon. You too can become a supporter of our podcast by heading to our Patreon site, www.patreon.com/thefirsttimepodcast.